I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Alon Nassan, the head of M&A and private equity at Goodwin Procter. Alon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be with you, David. Thank you for inviting me.
So we're going to talk about several things on today's podcast, your career arc, how you got into M&A and private equity, how you built your practice, how you think about the practice and the various kinds of advice that you provide your clients. And then finally, how you approach your business plan, how you went about crafting that, and how you use it in developing your practice further. So with that, tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to the practice of law and M&A.
Sure. It's great to be with you today. Like many people, when I was younger, in middle school and early parts of high school, I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do. People were suggesting become a doctor. So I thought about that for a while and realized I fainted the sight of blood. So that didn't work out for me. I didn't think I could be successful in that profession. So I pivoted. I happened to be very interested in politics when I was younger. I was very interested in humanities related courses as opposed to sciences. I didn't do as well in them. So I became attracted to those types of courses. And accordingly, I was a high school debater, which actually was very helpful and towards what I thought would be a career in being a trial lawyer. But I was pretty locked in on being a lawyer at around 15 or 16. Went to college and continued that trajectory and, you know, went to law school and luckily did well enough that I started a large law firm at the time, Skadden Arps, back in 1988, and was involved in two practice areas. I was involved in the M&A team and on the bank finance team. And I spent quite a bit of time there learning the trade at a time when, you know, hostile takeovers were really hot and really ubiquitous and really just affecting the economy in a way that was unprecedented at that time. The first giant LBO took place in the late 80s, the RJR Nabisco LBO. I had just started being a lawyer at that time. And it was just a very exciting time to be in corporate law and in business in general. So then I made my way to another firm thereafter, a very boutique-y firm at the time. It was called O'Sullivan, Graven, Carabel, which was kind of like a very, very small firm, even by the standards of the mid-90s, which is when I joined them. Very uniquely focused firm, just focused on private equity, effectively, with a little bit of litigation, but in the main, it was private equity. It was not called private equity at the time, and I did not know it to be private equity. It was just, to me, very interesting because it was a situation in which you got to work on acquisitions representing pools of capital where rich people and some institutions pooled their capital together. They bought these, you know, very boring companies, honestly. Boring companies that you'd find in the typically in the Midwest. It could be an auto parts manufacturer. It could be a distribution business. It was the kind of businesses that weren't that popular in the mainstream media. Nobody really knew about them, but nobody really thought about who produced pencils or who produced the rubber that's made in the tires. And I came to realize that the big three automakers didn't make the entire car, that in many cases, there were sub-assemblers and assemblers that put together different pieces of cars and made them available on the assembly line. So they were not the most exciting businesses. There were also other kinds of businesses that were just starting to attract capital from these pools of capital. And they were software businesses, technology businesses. And this predated the internet, actually. It was just starting to begin. So I'd represent people that were investing in a company that helped large retailers figure out how to manage their inventory and how to manage the distribution of their inventory and making sure that, you know, their inventory was stocked and restocked in the appropriate places at the various stores. And I didn't even know that it was called private equity. And I don't think it was called private equity. We called it middle market M&A. And the fun thing about it was the deals were typically smaller. You didn't get to read about your deal in the Wall Street Journal like my previous life. But what you did get to do was get a significant amount of experience and work on transactions that were really exciting. The businesses may not have been that exciting, but representing large pools of capital that were investing into these businesses was a very exciting thing. And nobody was really doing it. There weren't that many law firms that were doing it. And the people that I was working with, many of which I'm still with today, by the way, kind of formed an expertise in that area. And it was an area that got bigger and bigger and bigger, as we can see. as it's now a very large industry and a very large part of the economy. But in the mid-90s, it really wasn't.
And that also would have allowed you to have a generalist practice, because these deals were small enough. I'm assuming that you would have to do both the M&A and the financing work, which on a multi-billion dollar deal, probably even 30 years ago, wouldn't have been the case.
Exactly the case, actually. In fact, on the smaller transactions, you had to kind of understand different aspects of the legal landscape. You couldn't just be a specialist in M&A. You had to be strong at finance. You had to be strong at fund formation, just because they were so important to the process. It was very important when you represented an investor to understand what that investor's relationship with its limited partners or its investors was, and to understand what things they were looking for in the acquisition. So that became very important. So I had expanded my tools to include not just what I had been doing before, but I had picked up fund formation, and I picked up a little bit of employment law, a little bit of a lot of different things, just because it was important to know a lot more than I had known before. And honestly, I still think that that's something that is very necessary for success in this business, which is, and I think about it as a major and minor. Many people have a major, but it's very important to have a lot of minors and to be able to be conversant and somewhat adept at different areas, because it's so multivariate in terms of what you need to know to represent private equity sponsor or any kind of asset manager in a private equity transaction.
And how would you say that the fact that you had to have these multiple expertises has affected the development of your career?
In many ways, it's everything, because many people who are out there right now that do what I do, but just do it in one realm. So they're really good M&A lawyers, or they're really good at fund formation, or they're really good at finance. And I just think that it's important to know a lot about a lot of areas, and not a lot of people are willing to go out on a limb and try and make themselves capable in those areas and make themselves good practitioners in those areas. Of course, I rely on quite a bit of people, many, many people, to run the business and give me advice in those specialty areas like tax, fund formation, et cetera, because my real major is growth equity and M&A and venture capital. But the bottom line is, if you're not conversant in those areas, it's very difficult to garner the support and the necessary client base, candidly, because clients are not just looking for one kind of lawyer. They're looking for a lawyer that can speak many different languages. And you have to be able to speak those different languages in order to engender their faith and their support. And they're always testing you, because there are always new areas that are cropping up. But the reality is, if you stay on top of the curve and you consistently are able to show that you have knowledge in those areas, they're going to come back to you. And at the end of the day, it's all about revenue generation. It's all about being able to attract clients and have those clients refer you to other clients so you can generate more revenue for the organization. And I think we've been very successful at doing that here at Goodwin. We've got a very strong business where there are a lot of people that don't just play in their particular direct sandbox. They're able to and have expanded nicely into other areas.
Talk about, you came of age in an era when you had to be a generalist. For today's associates, the practice is much, much more specialized at Goodwin and firms like it. So how do those lawyers get a breadth of perspectives?
It's very hard, and you have to be a little bit aggressive about it, candidly. My advice to those lawyers is the following. I think it's important to be good at one or two things. Pick one thing, whether it's leveraged finance, whether it's fund formation, whether it's IPOs and securities work, or whether it's M&A. Pick one thing and get really good at it. But at some point, it's not enough. Because if you're really looking to try and build a business, if you're really looking to attract clients and have them put their faith and stock in you, you've got to know more. And look, they all know that you're not an expert in all these different realms, but they do value the fact that you are adept enough and conversant enough that you can engage on them. So you've got to pick those ancillary areas that you think will be very important to you. So for example, again, I started out with my major effectively being in, you know, on the corporate side, being in, you know, growth equity, venture capital, and M&A. But I realized that many very senior people at funds got very involved in the fund formation. And after thinking about it for a while, it made a lot of sense to me. I mean, if you look at the typical LBO fund, they invest in quite a bit of transactions, quite a bit of companies over the course of their existence. But the most senior people in the organization don't necessarily get involved in every single one of them. In fact, as the firm gets bigger, they probably get involved in fewer and fewer of them. So when you're working on one of those transactions, you won't necessarily be interfacing, and in fact, often case won't be interfacing with the most senior people in the organization. But I found that in fund formation, for example, because the fund formation is the lifeblood of the firm, if the firm can't raise more money, typically, unless they have permanent capital, if the firm can't raise more money, they're out of business. And I realized that it's very important to become not just a good M&A lawyer, it's important to become a good fund formation lawyer. So I really spent a lot of time trying to, and hopefully succeeded, learning about fund formation so that I can give my clients an angle on that is helpful to them, because if you can't do that, they're always going to be talking to somebody else. And, you know, the name of the game in this business is to always be engaging with your clients. And on the fund formation side, that's an area where they tend to engage quite a bit. And not necessarily in the fund formation, strictly speaking, in terms of negotiating with their investors or their limited partners. It also involves how they structure their firm and how they incentivize their people and what governance rights those people have and what governance rights they don't have and what economics they have or don't have. And that all flows into the fund formation. But when you're working with a firm on those types of issues, you kind of, hopefully, if you're successful, become part of the fabric of the firm, and they come back to you for more and more and more because you have history with them. You have experience with all the people that are there, and in many cases, people that are not there anymore. So you know everything about their history and about their current situation. And from my experience, that all flowed from the fund formation. So I decided that it was important to learn more about that area. Now, if again, going back to a typical young associate, that may not be the right approach for you. You may be in a different practice area, but you need to think about what the complementary practice areas might be for you. Because if you're thinking about building a career here, one approach I think should be to try and figure out how you can distinguish yourself from others and how you can engage as much as possible with people who are either clients now or about to be clients in the future.
In your own career, when did you make that transition? Talk about the transition from developing expertise in M&A and finance, and then over time becoming a partner and realizing that to build a business and attract and retain clients, you needed to go beyond that specific skill set.
Like many things in life, I learned by watching others, and which I think is a very important thing to do as well. Again, if we're speaking to the junior or the mid-level associate, that's very important. If you watch how others act in your organization, not just the people that you're working with, but others that you may not be working with, watch how they build their businesses and watch how they interface with clients. And they're all very different. There's no one way. In my case, I said to myself, look, I have to get really good at this. So I tried my best to get really good at it. And then after a while, I realized that it wasn't enough. I needed to figure out a way to engage more with clients. And I mean, if you do it long enough, and in my case, I've been doing it, this is my 37th year. If you do it long enough, this is a small ecosystem. I don't like using that word, but it's just so true here. The small ecosystem. So people that you went to law school with, people that you worked with at this firm that you're at right now or some other firm, or clients that you've worked with, junior clients that you've worked with, or even opposite, candidly, or even against. All these people don't necessarily stay where they are. I mean, in some cases they do, but in the main they don't. And they go somewhere else. And they show up in different ways in your career over the course of time. And if you keep track of all those people, you'll realize that they come back in different ways, in different capacities. And if you're able to be of advice or of help to them in that new capacity in which, you know, when you find them, you'll be successful. So in my case, I saw that there were people that I was working with, or that I went to law school with, or that were the clients that I was working with, but left the client to form their own business. So a new client, I realized it wasn't enough just to do what I did. I needed to expand into other areas so that I could help them as they progressed. And by the way, that's also true with existing clients. I mean, many of my clients that I've had, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15 years, it's a different client now than it was, you know, 10 years ago. It's got different people. It's got different objectives. It's got different infrastructure. It's got, candidly, in many cases, a different risk tolerance. And you've got to be able to evolve with them. So it's not enough to just sit there and say, I'm really good at X because you got to evolve with your clients and people that were your clients and could become your clients as they go elsewhere. So I sat around and I thought about that and I figured it out. And I said, I've got to immerse myself in some other areas so I can be effective or continue to be effective.
When did you first form a business plan? And how did you think about it when you first formed it? And how has that plan evolved?
So when I started, I was very, very young in my career. I just made partner. So I was probably, 8, 9 years out of law school. I sat down and said to myself, how am I going to build a business? And I thought about all the people that I knew that could help me. And I wrote down everybody's name and I wrote it down broadly. I mean, even relatives, friends of relatives, people I didn't know very well. And I spent a lot of time updating it and culling it and revising it. And I spend a lot of time outside the law firm now. And I did then too, in addition to my work, which was very hard, honestly, because it was hard doing a lot of work and drafting documents, negotiating them, and also making time for this, which was meeting people. I spent a lot of time meeting people for coffees, for lunches, for dinners. And you'd be amazed what you learn at these things. And not necessarily with a view to getting business from them, although that was always, I guess, implicit. But a lot of it is just learning about what's going on in your, and again, I come back to this word, ecosystem. So if you're involved in, let's say, AI, or if you're involved in broadly technology, you'd be amazed about the kind of stuff you learn from different people, just chatting with them over coffee, over lunch, over a baseball or a hockey game. You'll actually even learn gossip, or you'll learn about what's going on at your existing clients just because they hear about it and your existing client doesn't want to necessarily tell you what's going on. It's amazing what you learn about what you do just by talking to people and what kinds of publications you get exposed to, what kinds of other people you get exposed to. So I just started trying to create this web of people that I constantly engaged with. And in the late 90s, the advent of email and texting, and I was doing this before email and texting, but the advent of the 90s when email and texting became ubiquitous and came on the scene, made it a lot easier. So I was able to interface with a lot of people without necessarily meeting them live. And if you continue to do that and you continue to keep track and you continue to, and in many cases, in some cases, even write down notes based upon what you've learned from these meetings, it's amazing how, again, it takes a long time. It's not going to happen in a month or 6 months or a year. But after a while, it all kind of coalesces and you start to see patterns that come out of your meetings, patterns that come out of your lunches, your dinners, whatever interactions you have. And those patterns can yield or send you in directions that you wouldn't necessarily have thought about on your own. And those directions lead you to other clients, more people, or ideas about how you can change or adjust how you practice law. And it's actually what I find the most interesting. That's what I find the most fun, is having a large network of people that I constantly interact with and interface with. And, I can go a year without talking to somebody, but I try not to. I try to constantly touch every single person, at least on a regular basis, because there's a lot of data that I get out of that and that I try and keep track of that helps me maintain and hopefully in many cases enhance my business.
So do you think about it used to be called a Rolodex back when you had physical Rolodexes, your network of contacts in such a way that there are certain people you feel like you should be talking to once a quarter or even more frequently. And then maybe other people, you want to talk to once or twice a year just to stay in touch. Do you think about it that way or is it more organic?
I mean, it's very difficult to talk to everybody all the time. It's very hard. So what I try and do is there are certain people that have found have been so useful because of the way they think of the world and the way they think of what they do. They're just alphas. And, I always come out of sitting down with them feeling like I've achieved a lot just by listening to what they're saying, because what comes out of their mouths is just pure gold or platinum. So there's a lot of value that comes out of those people. And you can learn quite a bit from chatting with them and interfacing with them. And then there are people that, candidly, they're not at that level. But it's amazing what you learn about from everyone, not just necessarily the great thinkers. You learn a lot about what's going on in their business, how they're thinking about their business. Look, a lot of my clients are competitors and they all know each other. But even within that realm, it's amazing that there's oftentimes a divergence between how they think of transactions, how they think of target investments, what their valuations are, how they organize their institutions, how they incentivize their people. it's amazing how different it is, because everybody's different. Everybody's got a different way of thinking. Everybody comes from a different background. So it's just all very different. So again, I can't hit up every single person all the time, but I try very hard to do that. I also spend a lot of time with people in my organization, just because I think it's important for the younger generation to move ahead, learn, and it's particularly challenged because we're in a post-COVID environment. But look, in every organization, people come and go, and that's to be expected. But one thing that I've tried to do is when people go, historically, when I've seen people leave in organizations, people that remain kind of like, okay, well, that person's gone now, out of sight, out of mind. And I don't think of it that way. I think about it as every single person that I've worked with is a potential client, or if not a potential client, just a potential source of helping inform me about my business and about what's going on outside my realm. So I think it's very important to just utilize all your contacts, all your connections with people, even people that you used to work with or, you know, went to law school with or high school friends, whatever it may be. If you sat down and thought about all the people that could help you, if you're a young associate or young partner thinking about how to build a business, you'd be amazed at how many people between you, your significant other, your friends, you'd be amazed at how many people you know that could help you. You just have to think broadly.
How much time do you spend talking to lawyers who are in-house or lawyers at other firms or folks you went to law school with?
Actually, it's a big job and it takes quite a bit of time. So I spend a lot of time talking to all those constituencies and then some, because I think you learn a lot by listening to what they're doing, what's going on in their organizations, what others in their organizations are doing, and how their organizations are thinking. So it's a very all-consuming thing, actually, because it's more than just a simple conversation. It's oftentimes takes a fair amount of time. It can be at weird hours of the day, but I do it because this business is built on making sure that people think, and rightly so, that they perceive that they're getting the best advice, which is not just legal, but also business. So they want to know what's going on to their competitors too. And they're looking to you to be able to tell them that. And the only way to really do that is to really know what's going on everywhere. That takes a lot of time. So it's not just reading periodicals and publications. It's really talking to people at different places and figuring out who competes with who and who works with whom. And then to be able to help people know what's going on in the industry, because not everybody does. So it's really a full-time job.
At many private equity sponsors, generational transition is a huge, even fundamental issue. Talk about your work with sponsors in helping them change their ownership structure, change responsibilities as younger people at the sponsor want more responsibility and more of the economics.
It's actually the most difficult, and it's my favorite aspect of what I do, because it really requires a unique set of skills. And there are not that many people that are positioned to be able to do it. So why is that? Because ordinarily in the early part of the life of an asset manager, there's not that many people there. It's not that complicated of a structure. I mean, there are very few people that work there, maybe 3, 4, 5 people. One or two people may be in the control position and everybody else is not. There's not a lot of infrastructure on that stuff, just because everybody's more focused on getting the business up and running and there's not a lot of attention to that. But as firms get bigger, more complex, and as time goes on, they need more. They need more people. They need more infrastructure. They need more compliance. And candidly, their investors require it as well. So the question is how do you evolve that organization so that it's not just the original young business that doesn't have a lot of controls, not a lot of governance, not a lot of formality? And how do you evolve that to make it something different where you can incentivize a group of people that have been recently hired and make it more of a business that, you know, is intended to last over multiple decades? And there are very few people that can do that, because if you're the person that was with that firm at the outset, you know all the personalities, which are in many cases very divergent, differing types of personalities. You know about the people that were there, the people that have left, and how they were treated. And you just have a sense of history. And if you're doing your job right, although many of the more senior people may have independent lawyers representing them on any kind of an evolution or a generational type change, a lot of people will put stock in what you say and put value in what you say, because they know you've got history with everybody and you're able to more easily negotiate with them and their representatives, because you've got a lot of historical knowledge about what's going on or what has gone on at the firm, and you've got a lot of historical knowledge about the individuals. So it's very difficult for a new lawyer to parachute into the middle of that, because while they may know the law very well, they may know what's custom very well. It's very difficult to get that kind of knowledge and build that kind of rapport with the senior and the middle-level people at the organization. And honestly, a lot of these arrangements with regard to governance and economics are not set in stone, and they're not easily obtainable from other firms because they're typically not required to be disclosed, and they're oftentimes very unique, very confidential. So having a lot of experience in that realm is important. And I find, again, it's a great way to build stickiness with clients, to build business and ultimately generate revenue for our firm and our organization. Because like I said before, it's very difficult to go out and get somebody new to do that. So the easiest, and candidly at the point in time when they are trying to negotiate those generational issues, you want the least amount of friction, just because all these people work together and this is a situation in which they're negotiating against each other. You want to minimize the friction at that juncture. And one of the ways to minimize the friction is to have an advisor who's in the middle of it, who kind of understands where everybody's coming from, understands where everybody's been and how they felt they've been treated in the organization and what they're looking to do. And again, not a lot of people can fulfill that role.
And then finally, how do you decompress from the job?
Oh, well, in the early years, I did not do a good job of decompressing from the job. And many times I brought it home with me and I was told in no uncertain terms that it has to stop. So I did. There are many ways to decompress. And what I do is a lot of exercise. So I lift weights on a regular basis. I ride my bike, in many cases on the beach. I ski. I am not a great DJ, but I do DJ. I'm not David Solomon, but I am an up-and-coming DJ, and I spend a lot of time at the beach. So I spend quite a bit of time at the beach, both in Miami and in the New York area. I find that the beach is very calming, very relaxing. I also find that going outdoors generally, whether it's a forest, but just anywhere in nature, I think it's very calming, very relaxing. And to any kind of a high-stress job or a big job, really is important to put a premium on that, no matter how busy you are.
Alon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Such a pleasure. Thank you. Have a great day.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.